You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the next 2 weekends, BAM Cinematheque and the Jim Henson Foundation are presenting Puppets on Film, a festival featuring 54 movies aimed at children and adults alike. They range from features like The Muppet Movie to Being John Malkovich and Team America to documentaries like Making Warhorse and Dumbstruck. Two of our guests are the subjects of documentaries that will be featured at the festival, Kevin Clash in Being Elmo and Basil Twist in Arias with a Twist. And they join me now, along with Cheryl Henson, president of the Jim Henson Foundation and curator or co-curator of the festival. It's a pleasure to welcome you all to the show. Hi.
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 Yeah, thanks for having us.
Cheryl, how did you go about putting together the menu of films to be shown at this festival? How many films did you look at before you arrived at 54?
What was most exciting about putting this together were the number of new documentaries that were just made. We found that there were four or even five brand new documentaries made in 2010 featuring puppeteers and puppets. And the idea that there are these really excellent quality documentaries meant that there's a range of people interested in puppetry.
Do you think more now than in the past? Because puppets have been with us since for a very long time.
For a long time, but I think that the work has matured, and that also I think there's an interest in what people's lives are like. There are also a number of brand new shorts that we're very excited about that also all were completed in 2010. So it started off as a project to put all of this great work together, and then we added in some classic films that we were really excited about. And we pretty much just canvassed our friends and people in the puppet community and said, what are your favorite puppet films of all time? And that's how we put it together.
Well, when you talk about the puppet community, is that a small world? Were you all familiar with the various puppeteers and films before this festival began to be put together? Basil?
Kevin and I actually, we were like, oh, we've met before, but I work in sort of the artsy live theater world and have met Kevin before. But it's funny, it's a small world, but then there is a kind of distinction between little worlds within it. The live theater world
and
television puppetry and different types of puppetry.
Now that's why I'm excited about it, because I would love to see some of these films. I don't get a chance to, see what's going on out there. That's why I'm glad that Cheryl has been putting this together, because I can't wait to see some things that I've never seen before.
And do you expect to be influenced? After all, you have a pretty distinctive style of your own.
Oh, definitely influenced and inspired, definitely.
One of the great things about the Jim Henson Foundation is we get to see so much work because we're a grant-giving organization, and we look at about 140 applications every year, so we get a really good sense of what people are working on.
And is it how far-ranging is it? I was going to ask you about whether puppetry translates well to film, but when we're talking about puppetry, we're talking about an incredible range of things, aren't we?
Yeah, it's
from hand puppets to
shadow puppets to
marionettes. Sure. And do we include ventriloquists in this?
Yes, we do. Absolutely. That Dumbstruck.
You're very generous.
Dumbstruck is a wonderful documentary about the ventriloquist convention, and that's a marvelous one.
And then there's a film called Rubber. And then there's this short film about two snack bags in a vending machine that fall in love. They qualify as puppet films as well.
Oh, definitely.
Yes, they do. Absolutely. We like to say that any object that is brought to life is a puppet, particularly if it's brought to life in some way by the human hand. But Rubber, we put in, Lindsay Briggs suggested Rubber, and I just loved it. It's a tire that comes to life. It's an old abandoned tire, and it's a vengeful, nasty old abandoned tire that comes back and wreaks havoc on the small town.
And that's puppetry rather than animation?
It is, because it's not animated. It's everything in this festival is live-time performed, which means that it's not computer-generated and it's not animation.
Kevin, in the film about you talk about working for Jim Henson on something and the difficulty of making a puppet pull his eyes out, toss them in the air, and swallow them.
Yes.
You said it took you 29 takes. Would that kind of trick be shot differently today?
No. If it was Jim, no. I think it would have been done the same way.
Because he was a purist?
Yeah, because he feels as though, the physicality of all those puppeteers making that work is what makes it work. It's the camaraderie. It's the connection of everybody and the timing. And it just took longer than anybody ever expected.
But with go ahead.
I actually worked on that scene with Kevin because I was dancing one of the bodies on that one, and Kevin was puppet captain. And it was hard to do. But I think that another director today probably would use CG.
Oh, sure.
Because people aren't using live puppetry as much as they did in the 80s. So a number of the classic favorite puppet films that we chose do come from the 80s.
In fact, we have the problem of Yoda no longer being a puppet, which has disappointed a lot of people. But with all the new computer technology available to filmmakers, what does puppetry bring to films that CG and animation can't?
Well, I think the reality, the connection, the sheer reality of it. You know, to have an actor on film talk with something that's really there, you get more of a performance, I feel.
With animation, they do the voice first, and then they animate to the voice.
Well, even like Roger Rabbit, which I loved, you know, Bob Hoskins was talking to, you know, a tennis ball. Fortunately, I forget the wonderful performer who did the voice. He was off camera, and sometimes he would put the costume on and he would act it. But it's the immediacy of what you get seeing something right there.
When you see the children react directly to Elmo and the way that that character is so tangible, they can really reach out and touch him. And I feel like even if they're watching it on a television screen, they still have there's the immediacy, there's the tactile quality of that furry fur.
Well, sure. The Muppet movie was filmed in 1979, but there's a new one coming out later this month, right?
Yes.
It will use some of the more advanced techniques?
Well, I think it has. I think that's something that I mean, one thing that I think Jim would never do is the wires were taken out, the rods were taken out of every scene, and we feel as though that's the illusion of a Muppet. You know, if the audience is looking at the rods, then we're not doing our job. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, they felt as though that was necessary to do. We wouldn't have done that, and I don't think Jim would have done that either.
I think the idea is that the audiences expect to not see the rods now.
Yes.
In fact, some of the new the shorts that we're featuring in our festival have the rods removed. I think there is more of an expectation of the rods being removed. But that is an aesthetic choice, and it's definitely debated, actively debated.
Definitely.
Now, Basil, weren't your grandfather and mother puppeteers?
Yes.
So you went into the family business?
Well, a little bit. I mean, they were. I kind of have done it a little more seriously than they were doing it. My grandfather was more of an orchestra leader, and the puppets were a bit of a side hobby gimmick that he'd added to his act, but I still use my grandfather's puppets, and I don't erase the wires or the strings. I can't.
In fact, his puppets star in Arius with
the Twist. Yeah, they're in the film, the film Arius with the Twist, the docu-fantasy. So.
I have read that you're the only American to graduate from the École Supérieure Nationale des Arts de la Marionnette in Charleville-Mézières, France.
At this date, it's still true. Yes.
do the French have a high regard for the art of puppetry?
The French just have a high regard for all the arts. And so even in France, puppetry is still, as it is in the United States, it's still a marginalized art form. It's still a little bit to the side, a kind of strange choice of an art form. But it's definitely has a lot more support behind it just because all of the arts in France are supported in such an extraordinary way.
You've also done some Japanese
Bunraku style puppetry. Yes, I've studied in Japan, and I've had a lot of wonderful international puppetry experience.
The one of the documentaries, Puppet, says that some cultures have seen the puppeteer as a priest. You like that, Kevin?
Really? That's interesting.
Well, that ancient. I mean, it's actually particularly true in Asia and in Indonesia. A puppeteer is still considered a priest. A dalang is still considered a priest. That act of bringing something to life is considered a very sacred act, and it's part of what makes puppetry, in fact, so profound. I mean, we were talking about Warhorse a little bit just before, but just how how profound that experience is to see something come to life.
It's almost miraculous that we start believing that these puppets are real horses. And in the movie version, they're using real horses.
Right, which is, I think, is so odd.
Yeah, something is lost.
There's something about actually seeing puppets on film that, in fact, it captures that really simple magic that actually I feel nowadays with CG and animation, we're almost blasé about it. And there's something so simple that connects to a really, it's actually a very ancient part of ourselves, and it's that part of ourselves that where they say that puppetry and a puppeteer is like a priest or a shaman.
Well, both Adrian Kohler and Basil Jones of Handspring Puppet Company, the people who designed Warhorse, went to art school. Is that an unusual training for a puppeteer?
Puppeteers come from so many different kinds of backgrounds.
The people who came to Henson Productions, they came from all over?
It's a very wide range. Because puppetry uses design, it uses movement, it uses improv, acting, comedy. For Muppeteers, I think that improv performers are probably, and comedians, because the humor and the character is so important. But for the theater puppetry, more of a design background in sculpting, but you really need to be very flexible. And what's nice about working with puppeteers is they tend to not be caught in a little box. They tend to think more broadly.
Well, Kevin, how much improv do you do when you're doing Elmo and some of the other characters?
A considerable amount once you know the character. I've been performing this character close to 30 years. So, we respect the process of the script, which is, we have a lot of teaching that we have in our script. So we have curriculum that we can't get in the way of. But in order to really develop and create, keep a character three-dimensional, you play around with, and where that comes in is ad-libbing.
Do you remember the first puppet you ever made?
Ooh, it was actually Mickey Mouse. And then Hansel and Gretel, and then from there I built this puppet that was a monkey that I actually took from the inside of a coat lining of my dad's coat and cut it up and made a monkey out of it. And realized what I did afterwards. And I'm still living to tell this story that he said, "What's his name?" And he said, "Mondi." And he said, "Next time, ask."
And Bessie, you probably use your father's puppets, your mother's puppets.
No, actually, I mean, my grandfather's puppets were sort of these antiques that
you weren't allowed to touch.
They were a little bit spooky, and they were string puppets, so they were too actually tall for me to use when I was a kid. But I remember the first puppets that I remember making were, I made a whole bunch of like Star Wars puppets.
Definitely.
And I made like the R2-D2 out of those like pantyhose containers, those sort of silver containers, and a lot of stuff out of paper. And
so do you think most puppeteers start making puppets when they're very young? Does this grow out of play?
There is such a wide range of how people come to puppetry that some of the best puppeteers do start when they're very young, but my father didn't come to puppetry until he wanted a job in a television station. And he, in fact, had never done puppetry as a child. He started because he wanted to get a job in the television studio. He was able to get in by being a puppeteer, so he went to the library and got a book on puppetry and went and built himself some puppets, and that's how he became a puppeteer. So it's quite a wide range.
And Kevin, you started in television as well. You describe yourself in the film as shy. Was that?
Oh yeah, very shy.
Were puppets a way to get past that?
Oh yeah, I knew that at some point I'd had to stop negotiating with the puppet. You know, the puppet would say, "Okay, he wants $50. Okay, take it or leave it."
And you couldn't have said that yourself.
No. Well, I had to. That's the thing. I had to put down the puppet and negotiate myself at some point because it was getting a little strange for everybody.
And didn't you work on Captain Kangaroo before you joined Sesame Street?
Yeah, Bob Keeshan and Lumpy Brennan.
Wow. And I was surprised to learn that you weren't the original Elmo.
No. Brian Mule, who was a wonderful puppeteer that worked with Jim, performed him first and then went on to pursue his acting and writing. And then Richard Hunt, who was another seasoned Jim Henson Muppeteer, took him over and really didn't like him. Threw him to me, told me to come up with a voice. I came up with a voice. He said, fine. He took me to the producer. She said, fine. If you don't want to do it, he can do it. And so I had two two shows left with Elmo that season. I got through it and then tried to figure out what I was going to do the next season to hopefully keep my job.
And you've done rather well with Elmo. My guests are Kevin Clash, who is featured in a documentary called Being Elmo, Basil Twist in Arias with a Twist, and also with us is Cheryl Henson of the Jim Henson Foundation, who is the co-curator of a series called Puppets on Film, a festival that features 54 movies aimed at children and adults, and we'll talk about some of the other movies after we take a little break. Stay with us for more. We are back with Cheryl Henson, who is the president of the Jim Henson Foundation, co-curator of a festival at BAM Cinematheque called Puppets on Film. It's going to be presented for the next 2 weekends and features 54 movies, some of them full-length features, some of them briefer. And we also have with us two of the subjects of documentaries. We have Basil Twist, who is the subject of Arias with a Twist, and Arias being your partner.
Joey Arias.
And Kevin Clash in Being Elmo. And we have been getting all sorts of messages from listeners, including Bill Irwin, who just wrote in to say, I can say that Mr. Noodle never sees Kevin, only Elmo on the TV floor.
Yes, that's true.
So you really hide behind the puppet?
Well, what Bill hears is Elmo's voice on the floor when he's doing Mr. Noodle. So he plays to Elmo's voice. Elmo kind of helps him and guides Mr. Noodle through when Mr. Noodle goes astray as far as what he's supposed to be learning.
And the kids help.
No,
Mr. Noodle.
Totally, yes.
And Sinclair on Facebook asks, what does Kevin think it was that he did to breathe so much life into Elmo, who used to be more of a background character?
I think it's really just, we all have, we all talk about this, we all have our child in us. And so that's just a part of me, that's part of me that is that child, and that comes out through Elmo.
And a listener wants to know, Basil, what's the oddest object you've ever brought to life?
Oh, well, I've brought a lot of odd objects to life, but I still frequently animate plastic bags. That's a thing I do as a sort of a trick.
Is that easier than working with other kinds of puppets?
It's actually, in a way, I mean, part of the thing of animating something like that and bringing something like that to life is you just have to, you use the qualities inherent in it. So you don't have to actually force it to do anything. You can actually just sort of make it dance, and people see things come to life in it. It is, in a way, easier if you are attuned to it, kind of like being a jazz singer or surfing or something. You have to actually kind of be more attentive to the material than actually to manipulate it and make it do something.
Because the material isn't always going to do what you think it's going to do.
Exactly.
In the documentary about you and the one about Kevin, you both talk about the influence that the Muppets had on you. How old were you when you first saw them?
Well, I am totally of the Sesame Street generation. I was born in 1969. So,
and that's when Sesame Street went
started
on the
air. 1970, right?
Well, 1969. 1970.
Well, there you go.
Now I know that you're 42 years old.
Exactly. So everybody knows. So So that just, it was a huge influence on me. And then The Muppet Show, I was a total fanatic about it as a kid and had all the paraphernalia and the posters and the puppets and the things. And I also was shy as a child. So I remember I actually, I wrote a letter to Jim Henson as a kid, just expressing how important puppets were to me and how they really helped me sort of be in the world, which it's true. I also used to do, I didn't, I used, like if I had to do a book report or something at school, I would use a puppet to do it because it just made it actually easier to do. And of course, then you got like an A+ for creativity,
yes.
You know, your like bonus thing that you did.
But you never went to work for Jim Henson.
I never did work for Jim Henson. I met him at one of the premieres of The Dark Crystal. I grew up in San Francisco, and that was the only time I met him. Mm. And then I met Cheryl years ago, and I was very starstruck to meet Cheryl Henson when we first met.
And Kevin, you also grew up with the with Sesame Street.
Sure.
I'm sure with no thought that you'd ever
no.
wind up being one of the key figures in that show.
No, never thought. As a matter of fact, I was concerned that I would be left go any day if something didn't change as far as some character working. I was performing a character called Hoots the Owl at the time, and it was doing okay, but there wasn't enough scripts that were being written that I would think that they would keep me around. So that's why I'm thanking the Lord that I got Elmo by default.
Well, Cheryl, you grew up with puppets. Were the Muppets like siblings for you?
Not really like siblings. My father always kept the puppets at the workshop, and what we would do is we would come in and we would work in the workshop, and so we learned to build puppets and to puppeteer, but we didn't really do it. We like to think of it professionally. I think that both of my parents like to think of their work professionally.
So you were aware of the mechanics from a very early age?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we enjoyed that. And then I built puppets on the first season of The Muppet Show when I was only 15 years old.
Wow.
My sister and I built Singing Fruits and Vegetables for a fruit and vegetable stand that sang, Yes, We Have No Bananas. And we did lobsters
one.
For a lobster bandito scene with the Swedish chef. Those were our very first two scenes. And we loved feeling like we were being professionals, too. I think that that's what was exciting for us. But I would tell one story that there is one, my parents' very first show was in Washington, D.C., and was called Sam and Friends, or the first major show. They had a couple of false starts before that. But Sam and Friends had one character called Chicken Liver, and Chicken Liver is all of the other Sam and Friends puppets are now at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., except for Chicken Liver, who dissolved in our sandbox. So at some point, so there were a few puppets around the house, but for the most part, our parents encouraged us to take it professionally, to treat the puppets professionally, and I think we all did.
Well, how important, I throw this out to the two puppeteers, all of you, in fact, is the physical puppet? Are the materials important? I mean, Jim Henson introduced the civilian world to Fleece, didn't he?
There's actually quite a bit about Fleece in being Elmo, which I think is really interesting. I think it is such a wide range. I think it's the combination of the physical object and the performance. Ultimately, the performance is the most important thing, and what that puppeteer is bringing to it. But that said, an excellent physical puppet can make that performance happen.
Mm. My guests are Cheryl Henson, Basil Twist, and Kevin Clash. We're talking about puppetry. There's a series at BAM Cinematheque running this weekend, next weekend, called Puppets on Film, 54 Films. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Basil, when I asked you about the most unusual thing that you'd animated, I assumed that you were going to say the pieces of cloth in Symphony Fantastique, which is you do amazing things with underwater.
Well, that's the same principle that's used when I say a plastic bag. It just doesn't sound as strange. but that's that Symphony Fantastique, which was created actually just a few blocks from here, was it an abstract puppet show where I really tried to use the materials a little bit for what they were, instead of trying to make the materials be something else, trying to make the materials be an animal or a person, just actually use raw materials and exploit what their movement was and what their potential was and what their life was.
And you must have been surprised. Well, maybe you weren't surprised by the incredible response
that performance got.
It was
absolutely
surprised. Great.
Yeah. I was surprised. I had created that really for, I was working in what I thought was just the puppet world, and that was a piece that kind of broke out into a larger performance world where people were looking at that as a piece of dance, as a piece of visual art, as a piece of theater, as all these other things on top, as a psychedelic experience, on top of it being just a puppet show.
Well, you run a puppet program near here, don't
I do run a puppet program. We have a show that's starting this weekend down there called Sonambula. And it's a little theater, a little teeny, teeny, tiny theater, which is named after my grandmother. And my grandfather's puppets are on display outside when they're not performing in Arias with a Twist. And it's one of those funky downtown spaces that's an old mattress factory that's been converted into a performance space. It seats about 70 people. And there has been a lot of magic that's been there, and everything is so completely different.
Well, how did you wind up creating a show with Joey Arias?
I just have known Joey for years and years. Ever since I came to New York, I used to perform in nightclubs, and you would see Joey and was enchanted by him. And he would come and see my shows a lot. He saw Symphonie Fantastique, and he wanted to jump in. He wanted, like, you know, like Mary Poppins in the chalk painting. He just wanted to jump right into the shows. And if there was anybody who could do that, it's Joey. And he left New York for a while. He was in Las Vegas working with Cirque du Soleil. When he came back, he said that his art clock was ticking out there working with Cirque du Soleil. And when he came back to New York, there was sort of a cancellation in our theater, and it just happened. And it was magic, because he really does live in that puppet world. Only few performers really can totally just jump in, absolutely.
Well, you get to do a little Alice in Wonderland getting larger and smaller.
Yeah.
So I want to say that in that documentary, it's not just about the creation of Arias with a Twist. It's also about Joey Arias's life as a performer and sort of the art scene in the West Village in the 80s. And it's a very rich documentary. So
we should point out that puppets, on the one hand, are seen as something for children. On the other hand, they've always been a part of art theater, haven't
Definitely.
They?
Sure.
There's a very funny scene in Being John Malkovich where John Cusack, who plays a puppeteer, is performing a sidewalk puppet show of Tristan and Isolde. And after a little girl sees what's totally adult entertainment, her father punches John Cusack in the nose. What happens on Sesame Street? I've always wondered about that, because seeing things, some of the adult references on Sesame Street, I've always wondered... you know that a three-year-old doesn't have the foggiest idea
sure.
of what the joke is. You're definitely doing that for the parents who are watching
along. Oh, yeah. Sesame Street has always been written on for two levels, definitely for the children. But also they wanted the parents' participation to watch it with their child and talk about things. And so they wanted to entertain the adults at the same time.
Like Placido Flamingo.
Oh,
does
sure.
a kid understand who Placido Flamingo is
also,
based on?
Also, the spoofs that we do, you know, we just did one recently called Desperate Houseplants. You know, so that's definitely for the adults, because they watch that show, not the children.
But on another level, in your documentary, you're determined to find out how to hide the seams in your puppets.
Oh, yes.
How did you finally work that out?
Well, fortunately, you know, I met Kermit, and he showed me that great Henson stitch that actually Don Celine said in the documentary, in that film that we found of Jim and Don talking about it. And you know, it was amazing. You know, that's what I was, you know, really frustrated and trying to find out, is where could I find the fleece? And if I did, how do you make it work?
Mm. So you were searching for the golden fleece?
Oh, totally. Definitely.
I was going to say, my dad's first show, Sam and Friends, was not a kid's show. It was on before the Huntley Brinkley Hour in Washington, D.C. It was very jazzy and snappy. And I would also say that, you know, so much great puppetry over the years, over the hundreds and hundreds of years, has not been for kids. That it was very political, or it was part of a religious telling of stories, passing stories
sure.
on through the generations, and that it's really only kind of recently that we pigeonhole it as for kids.
No, well, even when I was a kid, Kukla, Fran, and Ollie
sure,
was on the air, and that was a two-edged sword. Some of the jokes were for kids, and a lot of it was for the adults.
No, the same thing. I mean, I watched Jim and, you know, Old Black Magic, all of those songs, and that's what I incorporated before I started doing television. I used Earth, Wind, and Fire songs. I did, you know, I was influenced by commercials, so I would have a mummy crawl up and sing I Am Stuck on Band-Aids because Band-Aids stuck on me. Those were the commercials that we grew up watching. I had a, you know, a cheeseburger sing to All Beef Patty Special Sauce, Lettuce, Cheese, Pickles on the Sesame Street bun. You know, so all of that. I mean, I had two skunks, a mother and a daughter. A mother and a daughter, and a daughter sang You and Me Against the World, you know, and Hella Reddy song. So.
So when people assume that when you say that you do puppetry, they assume that you're doing stuff for kids. Basil, how do you explain? Do you point out that on the New York stage now there's Spider-Man, Lion King, Avenue Q, yes. The Addams Family? Julie Taymor is going to do a version of The Magic Flute at the Met. And then there's also, I think, The Child in Madame Butterfly will be a puppet.
Also, War Horse and Satyagraha, which is at the Met right now, has extraordinary puppets. And in fact, there's this amazing puppet, really, that is over 30, maybe 40 feet tall, that's all made out of sellotape. And that's the artists, Phelan McDermott and Julian Crouch from Improbable Puppet Theater staged that. And this huge, you know, how they could actually manage to do 40-foot sellotape character, but it's like a spirit. It's a spirit
character.
But
you see it being made, being created on stage, too, which is so powerful. I think it's, I mean, there's, it's a lot of people have seen enough puppetry out of the children's context. I mean, obviously, people frequently mention Avenue Q to me, which is definitely not for children. and that it's not hard to convince people otherwise.
And again, we have a slideshow on our show page at WNYC.org. Kevin, I'm embarrassed to ask you this, but so many listeners have asked to have you speak like Elmo. Can you do a little bit about the BAM Cinematheque and the people who we've had here in Elmo's voice, or is
BAM
that...
Cinematheque? Oh, sorry. I'm going to push the wrong button. BAM Cinematheque. Cinematheque is a very hard question. I mean, a very hard word. But Elmo can't wait to meet Mr. Basil. Maybe we'll have a play date together. And Elmo already had a play date with Miss Cheryl and her kids. It was really wonderful.
And Miss Cheryl is Cheryl Henson, president of the Jim Henson Foundation, co-curator of a series of 54 films that are being shown over the next 2 weekends at BAM Cinematheque in Brooklyn, of course. And the schedule's on our show page, so you might want to check it all out. Two of the people featured in that festival are Kevin Clash in Being Elmo and Basil Twist in Aris with a Twist. And it has been my great pleasure to have them on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
¶¶